You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Thor,
Corey Doctorow, Brandon
Sanderson, Robin Mock,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Vanessa McGrady.
Thanks for tuning in to Author Stories. Before we get into today's excellent author interview, I'd like to tell you about a couple of sponsors. Devin Ford, his book Recon, the expansion series book one, is free right now for a limited time. So when you're hearing this, go grab it right now. There's a link to it in the show notes at HankGarner.com. Years after clean energy ended, the world's reliance on fossil fuels, a lull of peace encompasses all of humanity. Some think we should travel to the distant corners of the galaxy. Others oppose the idea, thinking that the harnessed singularity reactors are unnatural. When a terrorist group attacks the lunar colony, members of the United Nations peacekeeping force are divided as a result of the incursion. Years later, Lieutenant Commander Kyle Torres comes face to face with old friends as he's thrown into an assignment that could change everything, a reconnaissance mission with huge implications for humanity and science alike. Start the epic journey as Earth begins its venture into deep space where not everything is as it seems. From Devin C. Ford, the best-selling author of the hit post-apocalyptic series After It Happened. Free for a limited time. Go grab it now. I'd also like to tell you about my friend Crystal Pico Watanabe of Pico's House. The Pico's House website now has a new look. Visit Crystal and her team of eight people who help her provide services to fiction authors. Crystal's full slate of services now include beta reading, manuscript critique, developmental editing, line editing, copy editing, and proofreading. Authors, you can also inquire about putting your books in her Book Lovers Box, which is a monthly digital subscription box with a different theme each month. This is free for authors for a limited time. PicosHouse.com for all your book publishing needs. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Vanessa McGrady on the show with me today. She has a fantastic new book called Rock Needs River, a memoir about a very open adoption. Welcome to the show, Vanessa.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm excited to have you and to talk about your new book. But before we do, we begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
You know, my dad was a writer, so it was a very natural thing. And when I was little, like really little, I mean, I have these journals still from when I was probably about 7 or 8, and I pretended that I was a reporter, but I was interviewing my cat. So it's a whole extended, long, fake interview with my cat. And I guess that's probably where it all started.
I love that. Were you a big reader?
I was. I was that kid who was so annoying. I would come home. We had a library right around the corner, the St. Agnes branch of the New York Public Library. And I would come back with a huge armload of books and then ignore everyone and everything else until as I was plowing through those books.
I love it. Where did you grow up?
Originally, I'm from New York. And then in junior high and high school, we moved to the Pacific Northwest to the Olympic Peninsula.
Well, that's not culture shock at all, is it?
Yeah, it's definitely a fish out of water.
Wow. Both of your parents were artists of some sort, weren't they?
Yeah, my mom is still an artist, and she was also a prima ballerina, which not a lot of people know. And my dad was a writer.
Wow. What sorts of stuff did your dad write?
He wrote it. Well, his biggest thing was he co-wrote a book called The Pritikin Diet. Pritikin Program for Diet and Exercise,
okay,
which in the 1980s was a bestseller.
Right.
But he was mostly a medical writer. So he wrote books the Love Doctors and the Youth Doctors about, at that time in the 70s, a lot of the science was emerging about rejuvenation therapies, but also, you know, Dr. Joyce Brothers and people like that. So he would write about those things.
Yeah. So your dad was a wordsmith, your mom a ballerina. As a kid who grows up and sees her parents, exploring the world and doing things that not a lot of other parents, kids get to see their parents do. A lot of kids we watch our parents go to work, punch a time clock, and, you know, talk about the drudgery of life. And were your parents different from that? You know, how do you, when you have, a mother who's a practicing ballerina and a dad who's writing books, and even though they're, medical books, it's still something that not a lot of kids get to see their parents doing. What did that do to shape you as a youngster watching your parents live this kind of life?
Oh my gosh, that's such a good question. My mom actually was not dancing by the time I was born. So she was painting though. And they had also been divorced very early when I was five, and we lived with my dad. So we were primarily raised by my dad. I don't know, because it was so normal for us. I guess it just felt normal. And I think when you grow up in a situation like that, it's not impossible to see yourself in that situation as well. So yeah, I think it would have been, it just kind of runs in the family,
Right. Do you consider yourself more a New Yorker or a Washingtonian?
That's a good question too. I feel at home in both places. I'm probably not as much, I'm in New York right now, actually, as we're recording this, because I have a reading tonight here. Nice. But I think I'm probably more a Washingtonian, and I've been living in Los Angeles for the last several years. So since 2005. So that's my home now. But I love coming home to both places.
Yeah. So, you have this desire to tell stories, and you're from an early age, but when did it strike you that this is something that you might pursue other than just a hobby? Did you know throughout high school and college that you wanted to be a writer? When did it come back to you?
How some kids are like, I'll never be a Republican. My parents are Republicans.
Right.
I've sort of had that about, I'm not going to be a writer. That gets too slovenly. It's you just unstable. It's all this. And then in college, I didn't really know what else to do. I had different majors. I had a classical civilization and art history track. But I was also taking journalism. And then it was really in college when I thought, oh, this is the most exciting and cool and stimulating thing you can do with your brain, for me. So that's I guess where I started, was really in college, accepting the fact that, this is my karma.
Right. I'm very interested in people that study humanities and these types of things as education to be a writer, even though they may not intend it at the time. How did classical civilization and looking at, the way people interact with each other on a very meta basis, how do you think that informed maybe the way you look at people, and maybe has that informed your writing?
At the time, you're absolutely right. I would not have known it. I just thought, oh, this is so good for crossword puzzles. I guess that's what I can do with this. But really, when you study classical civilization, you get really steeped in mythology and story, and you understand story structure, and you understand the hero's journey, and you understand the kinds of stories that have been compelling people for thousands and thousands of years. And I feel like that's how we tell stories today, even if it's, a story on Hulu or something, or if it's like something like The Handmaid's Tale that's, been reincarnated a couple different ways. I still feel like we have all of these hero's journey that are steeped in mythology and to become modern mythology.
Wow. You worked in radio and newspaper. What drew you to those forms?
So when I was in college, I took a radio class and I've always loved radio too. I mean, I remember even, you know, being young and listening to the radio under the covers. I had this little like Snoopy transistor radio.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, and then sneaking that and listening to that. I feel like radio is your friend in the car, basically. And I just love radio. And then when I moved to New Mexico, I followed a boy there and started working in radio there, and then switched over to the newspaper when there became an opening at that place. So that was kind of my start in Gallup's little town of Gallup, New Mexico.
And did all of this feel like a natural progression to you? I mean, looking back, you know, that's always the fun thing, is to look back and say, if I wouldn't have made this decision that led me here and taking this job, that would never have led to this, which never would have led to this, which eventually led to this book I'm holding in my hand. You know, those things are fun to look back on, but do you see through those things the progression that made you the writer that you are today?
Yeah, I do. I do. And even something like, you know, I took a job in corporate communications at a utility, which seems like a departure and the complete opposite thing. But that taught me so much about business and how to run a business and how to communicate in those ways. And so a lot of the work that I do just for my, you know, day to day bread and butter is corporate writing. And so I wouldn't have understood that unless I had actually worked in that environment.
Right. You eventually started writing, about travel. You've written, plays, you've done, all sorts of stuff. What was it that gave you the confidence to begin writing, you know, commercially and publishing your work? And, what was your first avenue that got you going?
So when I started writing professionally, I was in my 20s and in that job, those jobs in New Mexico. So just becoming a reporter is such great training, and I would recommend it for anybody who is interested in being any kind of writer, no matter what you want to do, even if it's creative writing, to just work in a newsroom and have to bang out two stories every day. That was our minimum. You know, you learn to write well and fast and short and tell stories and understand people's stories. It's great training. And that's really, I think, where everything started for me.
Well, your newest book is a memoir. And I find it fascinating when people begin in journalism and reporting, because to me, it seems that a good journalist, a good reporter, needs to have an eye that can see the details in the mostly mundane. I mean, we don't get to write stories of huge disasters every day that are headline grabbers. Most of the time, we're reporting on kind of mundane things, the things that happen over and over and over again. But the reporter's looking for a new angle and a new way to look at this to give people an insight into, you know, things all around us. I would think that honing those skills makes you a good memoir writer, in that you know how to find the things in the everyday that other people will find fascinating. Can you speak to that just a little bit, about how reporting and journalism affects the writing of other things?
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I think, again, you know, the training of telling other people's stories thousands and thousands of times over really helps you understand your own story a little better. And then also really paying attention to what you like to read is hugely important. So there was a reporter for the New York Times years ago, named Rick Bragg. And unfortunately, that sort of ended in disgrace because some of it was made up. But his stories were so beautiful because of the details that he included in them, you know, whether they were true or not. But he would talk about, you know, the flies buzzing by its screen door and, you know, the chipped paint on the wall and, you know, like the little details that really helped you understand the nuance of a story.
Right.
Right.
Your new book is called Rock Needs River, a memoir about a very open adoption. As we mentioned at the beginning of the show, it's out, available everywhere. This is a book about you and your experience. First off, before the book became a thing, before there was a story to tell, what was the impetus that made this personal story of yours happen?
You know, well, I've started telling personal stories as an essay writer, I guess, personal essays. And when my daughter came along, her birth parents, she was adopted at birth, and her biological parents, we'd kept in touch with them, and they became homeless. And so for a while they stayed with us, and while they were staying with us, I wrote a story about it for the New York Times. And so I feel like it's just another story to tell. And that eventually grew into a book.
So you were writing the story for the New York Times. Were you writing as the events were happening?
Yeah, they were still staying with us when that story ran.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think just like a lot of writers, when you write your own story, you understand it better and you understand it in a different way. And sometimes that just helps us, you know, make sense of what's happening to us and how we feel about it.
Yeah. First off, adoption, a supercharged issue, for a lot of people, because a lot of times the adoption process is couched in a lot of fear. There's you're accepting a child into your family from someone else's family in most cases. You know, of course there are the cases where a child's parents die and then someone adopts them, but I think a lot of cases we're dealing with someone who's given up a child for adoption and another family takes that child in. And we know how powerful that is and what a great story of love that is, that a child was chosen and all of that stuff. But the dark side of that is that someone, had to give up that child. And I think for a lot of adoptive parents, there's probably, and we've had some adoptions in our family. My wife and I have not. But we've seen something. There's always a fear that the birth parent's going to show back up, or what if they change their mind? What if, you know, a lot of these what ifs and for a lot of people, there's a lot of tension and fear around that. How does one open their heart and life up to the people that gave up this child while not being fearful and not holding those people at arm's length?
You know, I think for every situation, it's probably different. In our case, Bill and Bridget, Grace's birth parents, never ever gave me a reason to think that they were going to change their mind. You know, no matter what feelings of loss they were having, they never teetered, you know, toward parenting publicly to me. So that was not a concern for me. And also that they were homeless. So where were they going to raise that baby, you know, or where were they going to, you know, when she was a little bit older, she was about 2.5 when they came to stay with us. I mean, there was just no way they could raise a child. And that wasn't really a question for me at all. But I think there may be other situations where there is that kind of question. And I feel like we often don't consider the birth parents' feelings, because there are three people in an adoption. Or three parties in adoption. There's adoptive parents, birth parents, and the child. And I think you always just have to be looking at what's best for the child. And usually it's keeping a relationship open. Even if that challenges your parenthood, you still need to have some kind of transparency.
Right. What about for your child? Were there ever concerns about, you know, what will she think when she's older, or how long will these people be with us? You know, were there ever those concerns about how she, you know, your daughter would think of the situation?
You know, I felt like if I didn't give my daughter access to her birth parents, I would not be forgiven when she was older. You know, I feel like, and that's one of the reasons, and one of the things that I say in the book is, you know, I wrote it really as a love letter to her to show that I did try over time, and sometimes I was successful and sometimes I was not, to keep that channel open between her and her birth parents. And, you know, I hope if she ever wants or needs them, they will be available to her.
Gotcha. When you had the idea to start writing this for the New York Times and kind of live reporting on what happened, what was your initial, I don't want to say angle because that has a connotation, but what was your perspective on the story that you thought people would engage with?
Well, it was for a parenting blog. At that time, it was called Motherload. It's called something else now, Well Family. But at that time, it was a parenting story because I had been doing parenting writing. But it was a story I hadn't seen anywhere else. And I think a lot of people had not seen that story. And I know that we're not the very first and only people to invite birth parents in. So it's not probably not that unique, but I hadn't really seen that story anywhere else. So I think that's why at the time KJ Delantonia, who was the editor, was attracted to that story as well, because she is also an adoptive mom, and she hadn't seen that story either. So I think that's why it made it into the New York Times.
When you're telling a story like that, kind of as it's happening, are you ever concerned with feedback from people, what they will comment on, and how, you know, people that are not in your situation don't understand all the nuances and things like that? Does criticism from people, especially in when you're in the midst of the situation, kind of reporting on it, does that ever factor, or do you worry about those things?
You know, I think I used to worry about it more than I do now. I don't care now. I mean, it's just like going up to somebody in the supermarket and asking what they think. Like, why do they matter? It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You know, and the criticism that I've seen of my memoir is, you know, I don't care what they think. I didn't write it for those people. And the people who have reached out and written to me and, you know, told me that the book was important to them, that's, I guess, who I wrote it for. I didn't write it for people who don't understand the nuances. And I would say most of the people who didn't like the book are not in, don't have anything or knowledge about adoption. But then there's been plenty of feedback from people who are not involved in any kind of adoptive activity that did love the book. So I just feel like you shouldn't do something for what people will think. You should do it because it's something, a story that needs to be told from you.
Well, you know, books, stories are so weird in that, we all have books and things that have connected with us deeply. And it's almost like the book was written for us. And then we'll have someone else who loves a book, and then we try to read it, and we're like, well, that just doesn't connect with me. I don't get it. It's just obviously not for me. I'm glad you love it. But it doesn't hit me the same way. But when we love something, we want other people to, and some people just can't understand that some things are just not written for them. And I think we've kind of lost that ability to be critical in the sense of, you know, that's just not for me, or, you know, and it's a sad state of affairs that people act that way sometimes. But
And I think we're so influenced by other people's opinions at this time too. I mean, you go and, I mean, I don't even buy shampoo online without seeing how many other people like that shampoo.
Right.
You know what I mean? And I mean, in some ways that's helpful, but in other ways it's, you know, a book is such a personal choice, and I'm more likely to read something if someone that I know and respect has loved it. So, you know, there's that lens as well.
So how long did this run as you were blogging about it? How long did this whole thing last?
Well, the whole thing, the book writing or the visit with the birth parents?
Well, I guess how long were they with you?
They were with us probably through the holiday season. So a little over 1 month, but less than two. And then they would come back periodically.
Gotcha. So how long did you write about it in the New York Times?
I just wrote about the one story. Well, actually, I did two. I wrote the story about when they came to stay. And then I also wrote a story about, it was a little bit of a different angle, but we tried to, Bridget, Grace's birth mom, and I tried to trick her we had lost a teddy bear, and then I got a replacement one. And then I tried to trick her. And so Bridget and I had this whole scheme about how to like do this teddy bear replacement. and it didn't go according to plan exactly. And so I wrote about that as well for the Times. But those were the only, I wasn't writing about it continuously.
Okay.
Those were the two things that I did.
So you've got a couple of columns that you've written, and you see that people are interested in the story and that you have connected with people and they want to know the full story, if you will. So I'm assuming that the pieces that you wrote for the New York Times were probably combined a few thousand words, maybe?
Yeah, if that, I think probably a couple, I think they're about 800 words each. So about 1600 words. Yeah.
So you've got engagement from people. They know a part of the story. How do you then take that, and make it full book length? Where do you look for where people would like more information? What was your process for expanding that out to a full book?
So there is something, and I'm not sure if it's still going, but it's called SheBooks, which are long form story, but shorter e-books. And they were run by magazine veterans. And so I had pitched Rock Needs River. It wasn't called that at the time, but I had basically pitched an expanded version of the story as one of those short ebooks, and it was accepted. But then the editor said, "I'm so sorry, we're actually not doing new acquisitions right now, but I feel like this should be a bigger book. And here's the name of an agent that might be interested." So I wrote to that agent, and that agent said, "This isn't really my, up my alley, but somebody is waiting for your call because this is absolutely her jam." And so I called the woman who would become my agent, Cheryl Pientka, and we had a wonderful conversation, and it was a subject that was very close to her heart because she's adopted, and she had done her thesis on open adoption. So she was really understanding what kind of story this was. And she signed me. And so for the next 5 years or so, I worked on a book with her. And she really helped guide a lot of what I did and what we finally sold.
Nice. When you are when you're working on a story like this, because memoir is our view of a story, the story seen from our perspective and through our experiences. How do you choose what a level of backstory to put in? What level of you're willing to expose yourself and your motivations and all, how do you start kind of figuring out where the story lives and how much of you put in it?
Oh, Hank, that was an epic battle. I mean, I have so many versions of this book with hardly any backstory, too much backstory, wrong kind of backstory. So I feel like after a while, it was a little bit of a crazy making process. And then I finally just said, the next time I change this, it's because the editor who buys this book is going to tell me what to do. So, and that's what happened. And so I have a wonderful editor, Carmen Johnson at Little A, who really helped shape the book into what it is, which is basically, leading up, the first half is about my family and my process leading up to become a mom. And the second half is once I'm a mom and our relationship with Bill and Bridget. So it's kind of cut in half, which I feel like is a good balance. I know, you know, some people would like more backstory, and then some people would like it's for some people it's too much. But for me, that's what the book is about.
Well, the book is a very powerful look at a topic that needs to be discussed more. But I think for a lot of people, we're just scared to talk openly about it and how families are affected and how real people deal with these situations. When someone is finished with the book, Vanessa, and they've closed the back cover and they're sitting there thinking about the story that you've just told them in Rock Needs River, what do you hope they take away from this story?
I hope that they have a better understanding of the nuances in adoption, and a little bit more compassion for people who may make different decisions than they do. You know, I hope to try to get that across in the book that, you know, not everybody is on the same, you know, logic plane as we are in the same situation. And, you know, some people just make decisions very differently, and we still need to have love and compassion for those people.
Well, and what a fantastic book to do that. Rock Needs River, a memoir about a very open adoption, is out, available everywhere. Vanessa, if people are just learning about you and your work, is there a place they can connect with you online to learn more about you?
Yeah, they can. They can go to rockneedsriver.com, and they can also see me on Twitter or Instagram at Vanessa McGrady.
Excellent. And we'll put links to those in the show notes. Vanessa, thank you so much for taking time to come on the show and share your story with us.
It's really been delightful. Thank you so much.
Missing Wings by Andrea Luman. Born with an ability the Viladi people of Madar believe make her one of the first to be blessed by God, Katrina's destiny unravels when her father is poisoned and her mother steals her into the human world to hide among those who hate her kind. In a near-fatal attempt to return home, Katrina is stripped of her wings. The poison meant to kill her father leaves him in a degenerative state. When her eldest brother discovers she has survived, he orders her to stay in hiding. She must wait, concealed in the human world, until the danger of their father's uncontrolled rages is contained. Grown and adapted to the human world, Katrina encounters one of her kind. The promise of home and the first love leads her into a situation capable of starting war among the Viladi. Will a human upbringing, mistakes, and the loss of her abilities bar her from reclaiming her heritage? Will unraveling the mystery of her mother's betrayal lead her family into an even greater danger? Missing Wings by Andrea Luman. The Locust, books 1-3 by Ralph Kern. The complete Locust series, an epic tale of mystery, survival, exploration, intrigue, and war. The cruise ship MS Atlantica is lost on these strange and uncharted seas where even the compass shows the sun rising to the west. Atlantica's passengers and crew must do what it takes to survive. In Unfathomed, Atlantica arrives in a strange new world. Unable to locate land with no way to contact home, they must find new allies, fend off relentless enemies, and discover the horrifying truth behind the Locust. The future of humanity will be decided as the fleet confronts the architect of the Locust. Not everyone will survive the desperate final battle. The Locust box set contains all three action-packed novels in this best-selling science fiction thriller series, Unfathomed, Expedition, and Osiris. Acclaimed for great characters, thrilling action, technical accuracy, and a compelling sense of mystery. Buy it today. The Complete Locust Series by Ralph Kern. Thanks for listening to the Author Stories Podcast. For more great author interviews like this one, go to hankgarner.com and dig through the archives. There's something there I know you'll love. Now stay tuned for a special audio clip from Richard Gleaves' The Jason Crane Series.
On Walpurgis night, when the moon is high, hell's bells ring and witches must answer. They dapple their breasts with rendered fat of murdered babes, straddle their brooms and take to the sky, as the devil wills, to speed through dreamy midnight air to the summit of the Brockenberg, that haunted peak shrouded in swirling mists, where a glen of gnarled limbs and wan moonlight awaits to host their debauches and blasphemies. Now to the Brocken the witches ride. The stubble is gold and the corn is green. There shall the carnival sabbat be seen, and the devil shall come to preside. The accuser elopes from the bowels of hell, a sure-footed, goat-headed, many-horned beast with cloven hooves and a staff of bone. He perches upon the witch altar to brood in cerulean half-light, a winged silhouette with watchful red eyes. The witches gather and bow to their master, upon his charred rump give the shameful kiss, then imps beat the drum and a round dance begins. Lash yourselves into frenzy, hags. Pass the chalice of pure marrow broth. Whip the ground with your hair. Tread the sky with your feet. Dance with joined hands around Satan's cold fire. Then find out a nook of nettles and moss and lay with the rough-skinned beast of your choosing, suckling some rancid teat of desire. But hist! The cock crows. Away, away! Gather your tatters and broomsticks and wits back to your huts, to your thresholds and hearths, and become once more, at the red break of day, the furtive adder in your neighbor's garden. The ghost host of the Salem Sorcery Tour, dazzling in his steampunk Victorian morning crepe, let the spell he'd woven trail through the twilight air like a hag across the moon, then chirped, "Isn't that silly?" and bowed, sweeping the wet grass with his satin-ribboned top hat. The tour group gave a polite round of applause. Nobody believes that stuff today, but the Puritans sure did. They took witches very seriously. If they went down in the morning and bought eggs, and one was rotten, surely the devil had come in the night, gone boop, tee-hee-hee, then scampered off on his little hooves. And who's in league with the devil? Witches. We're taught that the Puritans were super nice and cute with little buckles on their hats, but it's not the case, folks. They were fanatics. Witch hunts don't happen in a healthy society. They hated kids. They hated women. They were crazy. And that craziness. He turned on the spot, casting a protective circle around the stone garden of the witch memorial. Got these people killed.